And I had to go to the arena. And then I had to tell absolutely everyone in Arturo's life that he was dead, one by one. Because I walk in the door and, you know, I see my staff. I see Jolene, who was so close to him. I saw, you know, Mikey Red, one of his best friends. I see all of these people who were in his life. And I had to tell every single one of them. And then I had to tell Pat. And that's what I was saying to Jay Larkin the next day. You got what you wanted. You got exactly what you wanted. What did you think was going to happen? You've seen this guy melt down before. What did you think? It wasn't going to happen again? When he got in that accident, you know, we get the call and we thought he was going to die. And then, you know, a few weeks later, we're up in Providence and this psycho is training with this halo braid head on. I'm sure you've seen the footage. I'm coming back. And he did. It's a great story.
Hello and welcome to Boxing Life Stories with me, Tristix.
What happened in the ring after Tyson Oliver was child's play compared to that one?
Still a goosebumps to this day.
Just, you couldn't take the tears from his eyes or the smile off his face, could you?
I know.
I said, he's beating me. He said, well, let's pull him back.
And the paper, they made me look like Al Capone.
This is going to be your night.
There's winning and there's nothing else.
Hello and welcome back to Boxing Life Stories. This week I'm delighted to be joined by Hall of Famer Kathy Duver, who is one of just a select few women in the International Boxing Hall of Fame. I actually wrote Kathy's bio for the International Boxing Hall of Fame program when she was inducted in 2020, but of course that induction weekend and the 2021 one did not go ahead because of COVID. So when she goes in next weekend, or this coming weekend, she will officially be inducted, even though she's been elected into the International Boxing Hall of Fame already. Kathy has an incredible story, an incredible life in boxing, and sometimes these stories are made all the more crazy by the supporting cast and the people that these guys and girls work with. But Kathy's story as a standalone story is absolutely incredible. You've got someone who has lost her life partner at the age of when he was just 44, that's Dan, that was then estranged from the family, went through a massive amount of stress, has rebuilt main events from scratch, almost scratch a few times over, has had cancer and just endless battles within the sport. As she says here, she wouldn't change it for anything. And it's been an incredible journey and, you know, an incredible story of resilience. And like I said, really, there's some huge names mentioned in this podcast, but no one stands brighter at the end of it than Kathy, who I thought was an outstanding guest and obviously well worthy of her place in the International Boxing Hall of Fame. And she's obviously clearly incredibly modest, as you can tell from the start when we talk about her being inducted in Canastota in the next few days. Before we get started, I did want to thank our sponsors at Hansenly Resourcing. They were voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm for the 2020 Corporate Excellence Awards. Not only do Hansenly find you the best people, they'll help you retain them, and you can find out more at hansenly.com. I'm also on Patreon. My content goes up early on Patreon. There is unique content going up there. These podcasts do go up early. I am at the International Boxing Hall of Fame weekend this weekend, so I will be doing some Patreon exclusive content. And the last piece I put up last week was the story about the progress behind the current book I'm working on about the late great Matthew Saad Mohammed. But now, without further ado, here is Kathy Duver.
So I was going to say, Kathy, it's going to be great to see you get inducted. Are you actually already in the Hall of Fame? Because you went in 2020, but you haven't actually obviously been able to go in to formally be inducted. So are you actually in the Hall of Fame right now as we speak?
Not sure. We've been calling me elected to the Hall of Fame up until now, and I guess you're not inducted till you're inducted, right?
Yeah, of course. What was it like getting that call from Ed Brophy back in what would have been, I guess, the end of 2019 now?
Yeah, it was stunning and astonishing, and I didn't believe it. I never really thought it would happen. So I was, you know, sound like people. It's an honor to be nominated. I was amazed that they nominated me, so I didn't expect I'd get in.
But that's obviously super modest of you. It's not like you don't have pedigree to be going in there, right? It's not like it's a huge surprise. It can't be after everything you've done and achieved in the sport.
You know, it is when you know as a woman that all the people voting are men, and I'm really pleased that they did. But it is it's an obstacle, and if you say it isn't, then you're denying reality. So it was great, and they tell me my plaque is going to be next to my late husband, so that just makes it better. And that part of it, I think, appeals to me the most.
Okay. How much of it of your life does it feel like you've given to boxing? And I don't mean in terms of hours and years. I mean in terms of heart and soul.
You know, it's competed for a long time with raising my children. After Dan passed, they were still young. And I had spent a great deal of time with boxing up until then as well. I'd been working with him since I was on fights, since I was probably 19, 20 years old. So I had really, you know, I'd been in pretty deep at that point, over 20 years. But then there was a period where, my kids needed me a lot more. Going to the fights almost felt like I was abandoning them. So I was in and out for a while. And then once they got to the point where they were, you know, in college or beyond, then I was able to devote myself to this more. And it's, it is my life. And I realized at some point that if I walked away from this, I had already lost too much. I wasn't giving this up too, because it is my life.
Is that a kind of, I don't know what to say. Is it a kind of sick addiction that we all get to this sport? Yes. Where you can't live with it, can't live without it?
Yes. Yeah. No, there's times when I think, what am I thinking? Why do I do this? But there's a community. It's a very big community, not big. It's sizable, right? We know hundreds and hundreds of people that are involved in this. And when you go to a fight, you never go and not know anybody. Yeah. You know, in the rest of the world, if I go and I walk into a restaurant or whatever, I don't know a soul there. You know, I go to a boxing event, I'm very comfortable. This is kind of, finally, I feel like I belong. I don't know that I felt like that. Shortly after Dan passed, you know, and I was trying to figure out what my life was going to be like at that point, I'm not sure I felt I belonged. It took a few different things that happened and a few different incidents along the way, time, whatever. But it has been a process, and now I'm at the point where I'm very comfortable, and this Hall of Fame thing is just the cherry on top of the sundae to tell me, yes, Kathy, you belong. It's okay.
So, I mean, you say that cherry on top of the sundae thing, which is a great analogy, but that doesn't mean that you're done yet, right?
Oh, no, not at all. They're not getting rid of me. I have a wonderful staff. You know, we've gotten smaller with the pandemic, had to do what we had to do to survive. But we've got a small core of people that are tremendous. And we're still working with Sergey Kovalev. He's headed for a cruiserweight title. I'm an advisor with Dmitry Bivol, so I've had a pretty good few weeks with that. And we've got a deal with a company that Triple B Media, that is in the process of launching a boxing channel using our archive, which is vast as its space. And within a year or so, we expect we'll be doing shows on that network. So we're busier than we've been, certainly in the last 2 years. But we're pretty busy and looking forward to some pretty bright things in the future.
And you mentioned there, obviously, that you've been in the sport for a long period of time. Before that, you were a journalist, right? And I've specialized in covering in women's sports. But was that the dream when you were a kid to get into sports journalism and that side of things?
You know, when I was a kid, the dream was to get involved with sports. I didn't know how. I liked sports a lot. I'm an only child, but my father was a big sports fanatic. So I sat there with him and watched everything and, you know, learned all the games and learned all the rules of football, our football, and things like that. And so I was always a big, very enthusiastic about sports. And but I didn't know, frankly, it was my last semester in college when I took a journalism course that I realized, oh, this is the thing I've been looking for.
What did your dad do?
Oh, he was an insurance salesman.
Okay. And was boxing on the radar? You mentioned the other sports. Was boxing around? Like, was that a thing that you were watching?
He watched. He was that guy who watched everything, right? Whatever, if there was sports on TV, he was watching. So I was aware of boxing. You know, I knew it was out there. I'd seen fights with him from time to time on Friday nights when they used to show them. I really brought him into boxing more than the other way around.
Oh wow, that's great.
He ended up being the guy who collected the tickets at the door of our club shows, because we knew that my father would not let anyone in without a ticket. So everybody else that you got to do it, you get your friends to do that and stuff. They're letting their buddies in. Dad would never have done that. So
was he trying to sell insurance to them at the same time?
No, he was retired by then.
Okay. You obviously, so the first time around, you graduated with a degree in English, and then you got a job on a newspaper, right? In New York.
Actually, first it was a little weekly in New Jersey.
Okay.
And the sports editor there, he was very, for the time, he was very progressive, and he said, you know, I told him I wanted to write about sports, and so he let me. And I started out, you know, covering, you know, the local boys' sports. At that time, there weren't really a lot of women's sports. And ultimately, he encouraged me, and I got a job working part-time, freelancer with the New York Daily News. And they had a New Jersey edition, which was a very small section of the New York Daily News. And the New Jersey edition hired me to write stories about women athletes, because they, I guess, had gotten some mandate that you know, women's sports were now starting to be a thing, and they wanted to cover it.
Is boxing on your radar at this point, or was it only when you met Dan around this time?
At that point, I already knew Dan. So yeah, I was doing boxing. I was going to fights. It was probably my father-in-law Lou Duva was promoting fights. My husband and the whole family were helping him. We would sit around the kitchen table at night and plan the events. Lou used to hire Murray Goodman, who was an old-time publicist, to write his press releases. And God bless Murray, but they were dreadful. And I kept saying to him, I could do better than this. I mean, why are you paying him? I mean, he was getting a whole $100, you know? And I couldn't imagine why he would pay that much money. And when Lou saw he kept saying, you can't do it. Women can't do that. And when he saw my byline in the New York Daily News, he finally relented. So that's when I started being the publicist.
Oh, wow. Fantastic that it took you to prove it at that level to actually say, hey, I could do this.
Again, we're talking about the 70s. Women had to prove everything back then. We still do a lot, but back then it was unthinkable. At that point, my husband used to have to, with two athletic commissions that I can remember, New Jersey and Nevada, he had to convince them to let me into the weigh-ins. Women weren't allowed. And not long before I started, women weren't allowed in the press section. So I'm a dime. I'm very happy to say that things aren't like that now. And maybe I played a little bit of a role in changing that, but it was hard.
Yeah, so I recently read a clipping about the former PR lady, Patty Dreyfuss.
Yes.
She wasn't allowed into a weigh-in in Atlantic City. She was kicked out of Matthew Saad Muhammad against Dwight Kiwi 1. She was thrown out of the press conference. Out of the weigh-in.
No, she's the one who wasn't allowed, I was referring to as who wasn't allowed in the press section. In New York, at Madison Square Garden, apparently, like, I think it was Red Smith, somebody, a very famous writer, just would not deal with her, wasn't going to have a woman in there. I don't want to impugn Red Smith if I had the wrong
guy. No, I get that. Yeah, but I know what you mean. So someone of high establishment, so real pedigree.
Yeah. And he was, like, not going to have her, but she became very friendly with Dick Young, and who was another big time writer, I think he helped smooth the path for her. But she's one of the people that when I started, we occasionally worked with, because we're in New Jersey, we're right across the river from Madison Square Garden. When you cross the Lincoln Tunnel and you get into New York, it's like the first thing you see. So we were there a lot, and I knew Patty, and she was back then, and she really fought much tougher battles than I did.
Wow. Hey, so I saw that Leon Spinks came to Dan for help, and the money from Leon wanting Dan's help started Main Events. Is that right?
Well, that's not the way quite it happened, but...
Okay.
So Leon was managed by a guy named Mick Barnes, Leon and Michael. They came out of the... He was their amateur coach. They come out of the Olympics with gold medals, this amazing team of 1976. And Mick brings them with Top Rank. Top Rank, I think, signed a few of them, but the Spinks brothers certainly were among them. There came a point, Butch Lewis was working for Top Rank at the time, and Butch started insinuating himself in with the Spinks brothers, as you might imagine. That is when he began his relationship with Michael Spinks.
Right.
Mitt Barnes, who was a truck driver from and a member of the Teamsters Union from Missouri, where the Spinks brothers were from, he ran into Lou Duva, my father-in-law, at a boxing convention of some sort. And Lou, at the time, was not a full-time boxing person. He had a Teamsters Union local. So he was a labor union worker. And so Mitt bonded with him over their shared membership in the Teamsters Union and went to the bar and started telling him his sad story about how Mitt Barnes was pushing him out. Butch Lewis was pushing him out with the Spinks brothers. So Lou said, you need a lawyer. And Mitt said, well, I can't afford a lawyer. So he said, no problem. My son just graduated law school and he'll be happy to represent you. That was true. Dan had just graduated law school. He had not even taken the bar exam yet. So he was not able to practice law. The way it works here is once you graduate and you take your bar exam, you wait several months before you find out if you pass. So during this summer that he finished law school, he took his exam and he got a job working at a small local firm, waiting to get his passage notice. So it was during that fall then when Dan ended up working with the partner that he was working for, with Mitt Barnes, and making sure he was going to get paid. And it was during that period, shortly after he finished law school, that Leon Spinks did the unthinkable. He beat Muhammad Ali. And Dan was at the fight in Las Vegas. I remember watching it on TV with his family in his den in his house. And Dan told me that he was sitting next to some stranger and they made a bet, man to man, $100. Dan bet on Ali. He was his idol. He couldn't imagine anybody was going to beat Muhammad Ali, especially Leon Spinks, of all people. So Dan, of course, lost his bet, and the guy next to him, Dan explained, the guy next to him is jumping up and down, yelling and screaming, that he won. And he looks at Dan, and Dan is even more excited than he is. And the guy says, well, why are you so happy? And Dan said, I've got 5% of Spinks. Because Mitt had to pay him on a percentage based on what he collected, because he didn't have any money to pay him up front. So Dan was taking this job, basically on the come,
Yeah.
So that is how he earned enough money that he could no longer tell me that we didn't have enough money to get married. So we ended up getting married. And then the thing that actually gave us the financing we needed to really get the company going was they were doing, at that point in the early 80s, in 1980, closed circuit fights came back. They hadn't existed for a while since Ali was a star. And Ray Leonard and Duran fought each other. And we were able to get the franchise to do all the closed circuit in New Jersey. So that's the first time we ever really made money.
And oh, wow.
The business, yeah.
So in that sort of transition period where you're trying to get Main Events off the ground, what are you doing? Are you working as a publicist, or are you literally just spinning all the plates and doing anything that needs to be done?
Now, at that point, I was working as a publicist at a local college, at William Patterson College. I became their assistant publicist, so I learned how to be a PR person that way. And my husband was working in a law firm. We couldn't afford to support ourselves. I left my job. Dan made the deal for Leonard to fight Hearns in... I guess it was the end of 1980. That fight took place in September of 81. At that point, we were both working other jobs. In January, February of 1981, that's when I left my job and I went to work full time for the boxing. I'm not getting paid, of course. Dan was still working for the law firm. He didn't quit his job at the law firm until the fight happened.
How crazy is that, though? I mean, how does Dan get involved, and how do you guys get involved in Leonard and Hearns when you're doing other stuff anyway, and you're not even full time at the gig, and you wind up with the biggest fight in the sport of the time?
Yeah, we were doing real little tiny fights in a local ice rink, and that was our claim to fame. We were doing like pretty well. People were coming, we were selling out, and so you know we're maybe making $2,000-$3,000 on the show. We thought we were great. Because it was extra money, you know. What happened was Dan's friend at the time, Shelley Finkel, who's a great networker, and he was networking with Emmanuel Stewart, who handled Hearns, and with Mike Trainer, who handled Leonard. And Shelley is still great at basically, you know, sitting down with people and making them see his vision, you know. So at that time, Mike Trainer, who handled Leonard, who was a kind of a curmudgeon character. He got mad at Bob Arum and Don King. He just had it up to here with both of them. And I think he decided at that point, and Shelley kept telling him, you know, you could do this fight and I can put together the financing for you, which he did. And, you know, and I can find, you know, I've got this guy, Dan Duva, who can actually promote the fight and you can do it without Arum and King. So I think Mike decided he was going to prove that any moron could promote a fight, because I think that was kind of his attitude. And fortunately, the moron he chose was a lot smarter than he thought. And Dan used that fight as an opportunity to learn. So he hired a person who was an expert who ran the Superdome. So he knew all about, who had previously run the Superdome. So he knew about the site, right? Everything that went into the site. And he hired a woman who was the box office manager for the Ice Capades, which was a big touring company which went all over the country. So she knew about box office, you know, and on and on and on. He found an expert in every facet, insurance, the broadcast, anything that we knew nothing about that we needed to do in order to make this fight happen. And we didn't, you know, in the end, once he paid all of his experts, we didn't make very much money, but when it was over, he knew everything he ever needed to know about how to promote a fight. And from then on, he handled it all himself.
Wow.
Smartest person I've ever known.
I was going to say, it's a terrific way of looking at it, because a lot of people would look at maximizing the margins and try and do everything on the cheap to try and get the biggest margin. But obviously, he set up a business, an industry of his own from one fight, with the knowledge he learned by spending a bit more.
Well, and he was 29 years old. I was 27. We walked into Caesar's, you know, everybody else in our family was home running the closed circuit. Most of the money we made off of Leonard Hearns was what we made in New Jersey running the closed circuit. Because that was before pay-per-view. And so closed circuit, everybody went into a theater and watched it and paid admission to go in. And so the whole family, all our friends, they couldn't go. It was just me, Dan, and Lou that went. And we walk into Caesar's Palace, the two of us. Imagine what we must have looked like. Oh, yeah, we're here to run everything. The biggest fight. It was the biggest fight of all time when it happened. And it was an astonishing. We were there for 3 weeks. You know, there were no fax. They didn't even have fax machines. They had a thing called a quit machine. It was the first time we ever saw one. We bought one, and all the people we were working with had to buy them. And it was a kind of a mimeograph that worked. It took about 20 minutes to send a page, but that was like, to us, was lightning speed communication. You couldn't, you know, there was no internet. You had to send people hard photographs and, you know, little tapes of the commercials that we made, and press kits that contained all the information. There wasn't a way to just push a button and suddenly it gets to everyone. We also had to learn, we did learn about pay-per-view, because that was the first fight where there was any pay-per-view component at all. There were a few little systems in different states in the United States that had just gone up and running. They all had like one channel, and they were satellite delivered, and they had one channel. And so for that night, they didn't show any movies. They showed the fight, and the numbers were astonishing on those channels. They had uptake over 30%. So everybody is like extrapolating this now to oh my God, when we get to pay-per-view, you know, 30% of the people in the country are going to watch it.
Wow.
But sadly, the companies that did that, because they only had one channel, they went out of business pretty shortly. As soon as somebody figured out how to deliver more than one channel, they were done.
So, like, even so, it was still a success, massive success. And like, did you know then that pay-per-view was going to be the way forward? And obviously where we're at today, did you know that was where boxing was heading then?
Yeah, Dan knew. I didn't know anything. Dan knew everything. He was quite sure. That's why he made the deal with these little systems. He wanted to see how it worked.
You've mentioned Lou a couple of times. What were your very first impressions of Lou?
I came to dinner at Dan's house and I sat down, and I was a picky eater up until that day. And he looked at me and, what's the matter? Why aren't you eating? So I gained 10 pounds, and I learned that for the first time in my life, I gained weight. And I learned that, you know, I had to eat everything or he would not think very highly of me. So it was a big Italian family. And, you know, it was all about meals, but everything revolved around meals. And then when the meal was over, we worked on the same table. It was all about eating, and it was fun. And being with him was always fun, because he was, even in the very beginning, he was a minor celebrity. He got bigger as time went on. When we started doing fights on ESPN and people were seeing him on TV, but even in the very beginning, there were places he would go and people recognized him. So it would be his entourage. That was kind of fun.
Hey, how well did you know Al Serto?
I know Al. He, God bless Al. He made the suit that my husband's buried in.
Oh, wow.
He's a tailor too. He was a really good tailor. And I finally convinced my husband to get a tailor-made suit, because he was pretty overweight and things didn't fit him well. And he made a beautiful suit for him. And Al used to put a little thing on the inside of the pocket with the name of the person that he made it for. And when Dan got the suit, it had someone else's name in there. And clearly it was something that somebody didn't pick up, and Al must have altered to fit Dan. And at Dan's wake, Al showed up and he showed me. He had embroidered this patch that said, you know, made for Dan Duver, and he put it inside the suit jacket.
So oh, that's brilliant.
Name. Al had, you know, he had a great sense of humor. He and my father-in-law would fight like cats and dogs, and yet, you know, loved each other. But so, he's quite a personality.
Yeah, I mean, on this podcast, there's been mixed reviews of Al's suits over the years, with some saying that they didn't fit at all, and some were quite complimentary. So I guess you're somewhere in the middle. Maybe the suit fitted, but it wasn't the right one.
It wasn't the right one, but in the end, it was. So when Dan got to have the suit,
Sort of related to Al, I suppose. Obviously, Al was linked to the mob and, you know, the comings and going from that tailor shop and stuff. Have you ever been exposed to any of those guys through the years? Your Gottis and all of that lot from the 80s and 90s?
They used to come to the fights all the time. So I met a lot of them. But there was this, at least to the extent that we were involved, there was this myth that, you know, they ran boxing. And imagine they may have done in the decades before I got involved. But what I saw after that was a few of these guys would get involved with a fighter, and the fighter would invariably not be very good, and they would spend a great deal of money on this fighter. And there was just nothing you could do to do at some point to take a not very good fighter and keep them winning. So most of the guys like that who were, you know, had any relationship to boxing, at least in my personal experience, were these people who were being taken advantage of by fighters.
Yeah,
they
sure.
They weren't running anything we were doing. They really weren't capable.
So 1984, there was a bit of a sea change, wasn't there? Because obviously you signed so many of the Olympians with Mark Breland, Evander, Purnell, Meldrick Taylor, which, I mean, just such an incredible list. Also Tyrell Biggs. Yeah. Did you think, you know, obviously when we talk about that now, you can see almost a bit of a change in terms of the sport and the pattern of the sport changing from simply Aram and King to you opening up the marketplace drastically. Did you realize how significant that was?
Oh, yeah. Actually, in earlier than that, in 1980, we signed a group of the U.S. didn't go to the Olympics. We were fighting with Russia then too. There were a number of fighters who either made the Olympic team or didn't go for the Olympic team because they knew they weren't going to go to the Olympics. And we signed a few of them. And that included Johnny Bunkus, who would have been on that team, and a few others, Bobby Chez, on and on. And at that point, Dan had been trying to find, and a year or two before that, we signed Rocky Lockridge, who was, in the end, turned out to be a pretty damn good fighter. And Dan was trying to find a way to move Rocky without having to deal with King or Aaron. And he would call up NBC, ABC, CBS, the three big channels in the United States at the time. And they would all tell him the same thing. Well, you've got to bring your fighter to Bob Arum or Don King. And one day he called up NBC and he got a guy named Don Allmire, who ended up becoming a very, very big executive there in time. And he told Dan, don't give up. The door is going to open for you. Dan wasn't the one who opened the door. It was Murad Mohammed. He did a fight with James Scott, who was in jail at the time, NBC carry. That's what opened the door. We went right behind him, and NBC started working with us and Arum, because we still had to work with Arum. We hadn't proved ourselves with this group of fighters they called Tomorrow's Champions, who were fighting on NBC. Again, still with Arum. At some point, Dan came to the conclusion that Arum had breached his contract with us, and Dan took him to court and won. And we ended up getting those fighters. And now they were fighting on NBC, and we were free of Top Rank. At that point, he was dealing with a young lawyer at ABC, he and Shelley Finkel again, working together. There was a young lawyer at ABC named Bob Iger, who became the chairman of the Disney Corporation.
Yeah, sure.
Because you know what, if you can deal with boxing people, you can do anything. And Bob and Dan were really great friends. They really did admire each other and they loved working together. And Dan and Shelley made that deal with Bob Iger to bring the Olympians that we signed in 1984 to ABC. And that was really, that was our big launch. That was when people took us seriously.
Wow, that's really interesting. So I've spoken to Murad in the past, and he's a super interesting guy. He's obviously, I don't know. He's certainly his own man, isn't he? He's definitely his own best hype man. He's great. But he was talking about Bob Iger there, and I've read Bob's book, which recently came out about being a CEO of Disney, which is a terrific read. But yeah, like you said, like that thing, if you can deal with people in boxing, you're pretty well equipped for real life, right?
I tell all the young executives I meet at TV networks about Bob.
Yeah.
And there were a couple of others that we dealt with at the other networks who also made it up very, very high into their businesses. And I really do ascribe a lot of that to being able to handle people like Don King and Bob Arum and my husband and if you can make things work with that group, you can do anything.
True. And would you add Murad to that list?
Oh, absolutely. No, he's a very colorful character, let's put it that way. And you know, he's from Newark, New Jersey. That's like 15 miles from where we're from. So we knew him for a long time.
Yeah. You also mentioned James Scott there. So I recently done this podcast with Bob Hattrack, who was the old prison warden in Rahway, who helped put the program together. So let me play sort of word association with you. Let me chuck a few names at you and you can tell me a story or so. Evander.
Most stubborn person I've ever known and the most amazing.
Is that stubborn a good quality or a bad quality or both?
It's both, of course. But his stubbornness is the secret to all of his success. He would not take no for an answer, and that has become my mantra when people say, how do you become successful? Don't ever take no for an answer. They said he was too small. They said he did, you know, he couldn't possibly compete at the heavyweight level. They said he didn't have enough skill. He when he started with us, he was having trouble in the gym going two rounds. He would get exhausted. That's how far he went. And he, to this day, always the role model of someone who determined to be successful and made it happen.
How about Lennox?
Lennox is so amazingly physically gifted. Doesn't have the, I don't know, come up with the right word. in order to say something that sounds wrong. Like Evander, Pernell Whitaker, they love to box. They love to be in the ring and mix it up. That's their joy. I don't think Lennox likes it as much. I think Lennox saw it as a way to get what he wanted and did that very successfully. And with his frame and with the way he fought, he made himself successful too. But Lennox is, I guess, stubborn in his own way too, but more of a guy who thinks it all through and decided this is my goal. Here's how I'm going to get there. Whereas I think Evander just kept moving forward. Different mindsets, but they're both getting the same, ending up in the same place.
How about Michael Mora?
Michael. So there's this little bit of crazy in Michael that drove him. And I think it's still there. And you know, again, made working with him a lot of fun sometimes, and then other times not so much. But he's another guy who clearly is an overachiever, getting up into a weight division he didn't need to be in to be successful and finding a way to do it.
How about Meldrick Taylor?
Now, Meldrick was so physically gifted, but he never had the ring intelligence. That's the word we use now, right? Ring intelligence.
Yep. Or the ring IQ, yeah.
IQ, okay. That he didn't have. He had such amazing physical gifts that when he was young, he could beat anybody just by being in a ring with them. But when he got a little bit older and his reflexes started to slow and his legs started to slow like everybody does at some age, at that point, then he couldn't compete anymore. And that to me was the sadness of him, that his career, you know, burned bright and fast, but there was no way he could have continued because he didn't, during that time when he was imposing himself physically on everyone, he did not learn all the tricks and all the things that a more experienced fighter knows. And so he was unable to compete at that level as he got older.
How were you on the night of his first fight with Chavez?
Okay. That is the most heartbreaking loss in the history of sport. And I have defied people to come up with one that was worse, and no one ever has. Because it's not like you were down by one point and the bell rang, or you were, you know, in a football game before you could make another touchdown, or that you were, you know, down by a point at the buzzer, like you might be in a basketball game. He was winning the fight by far. He had won the fight. He got knocked down. He got up, and I have watched that tape more times than I can count. There are nights when I see it in my dreams where Richard Steele is counting and turning around between counts and looking at Chavez, who is leaving the neutral corner, who is in the middle of the ring at one point, and just turning around and saying, go back. And he keeps counting. And he turns around and says, go back. Now, a referee at that point, when a guy is in the middle of the ring, is supposed to stop counting, go back, put him back where he's supposed to be, come back and count. Then I watch him, literally, there's lights flashing over Meldrick's head and Richard Steele is facing them on the ring post that are signaling that there's 10 seconds left and they have been flashing for a while. And he almost looks like he's speeding up the count. And then instead of, which you might do with a champion when the fight's over, wiping off his gloves, talking to him, doing all the things that I saw Richard Steele do over and over and over again. I made a study of it after that. He did it every single time a guy got knocked down. And he didn't do any of that. He just waved the fight off with like 2 seconds left. I was so upset. But we were fighting Don King. And we had never won a decision against Don King. No one ever won a decision against Don King. It wasn't done. And so I went around the ring when it ended and I went and looked where they were looking at the scorecards thinking, oh, I wonder how far behind he was because I really, even though we thought he was winning, we didn't think they would ever give it to him. And I looked at the scorecards. That's when I got upset, when I saw that he had won the fight. And I remember there was a guy named Duke Durden who was close to King, who was on the commission in Nevada. And he was very upset because the scorecards had Chavez losing. And he was cursing about it and very upset. And I had had it up to here. And again, I just turned around this is the first time, or one of the many times I've learned that women can't say the same things men do and get the same result. And I just turned and said, "Will you just shut the F up?" You know, and I said it, I cursed. And he turned to me and he cocked his fist and he was about to punch me. My brother-in-law, Dino, God love him, little skinny Dino jumped between us and saved me. But I just remember that night as just being so heartbreaking. Dan had made a deal 2 days before with HBO for Meldrick for a huge, huge, huge contract where he was going to be paid multi-millions of dollars. And so that deal never came to be. And I do believe that night altered the course of his life irrevocably. I don't think he ever recovered from it.
That's super sad. Okay. Hopefully slightly more positive one here. Fernando Vargas.
Yeah, no, Fernando is a force of nature, and he's he's another extraordinary personality. And I'm so happy to see him now. You know, his three sons have turned pro, and he's managing them and working with them. And it's like he's come alive again. You know, he's got a purpose, and he's always. You know, he's always been Fernando, okay? He's always this charismatic personality that's going to draw you into his orbit. But his boys are spectacular young men. And he and his wife, Martha, who is truly a saint, who Fernando will tell you is responsible for the three young men that they've raised. But they've got a really nice situation now, and I'm really happy for them.
Okay, a couple more names that I'll just drop. Andrew Galotta.
Oh my God!
I'm picking some characters here, aren't I? I'm amazed you look so young, Kathy, because these names would probably make anyone great. They're making me gray even talk about them.
I'm quite sure they did. Andrew. Well, look, I don't know how to describe the heartbreak of watching this guy beat Riddick Bowe twice and blow it up, which he did. We learned later he was having panic attacks. We know what those are today. We didn't know what they were then. We didn't understand them, but that's what he was doing. He was having panic attacks in the ring. He was looking for a way out. And that's why he hit below those two times. And he did it. He won the first round against Mike Tyson. He was boxing beautifully. And then he just, you know, he just
capitulated. Blew up.
That's what he did. He would have a panic attack and then he would be looking for a way out. So he would commit a foul. And I don't know if the word's proud to say, that I wrote the letter that ultimately got him his citizenship in the United States. He's a proud citizen now. His wife, Mariola, is a lovely woman. He has a beautiful family. And he's still a huge star in Poland. He can go there and he does TV work and advertising stuff. And, you know, he's got a nice life. I'm happy for him, too.
Wow. How about Bobby Chez?
When Bobby turned pro, you know, our story, which it might have been a little apocryphal, was that he skipped the senior prom to have his first pro fight.
That's brilliant.
He also, you know, talked about how he gave up his opportunity to be a doctor and to be appointed. I don't think any of that was true. Back then, like, you could just say anything. There was no internet. Nobody checked anything. So we would make up these stories, and some of them were made with this wonderful man named Mike Cohen, who was a publicist at NBC. And he died very young. He was a wonderful person, and he was a wonderful publicist, and I learned a lot from him. And he would just create these storylines about Bobby that were, you know, totally made up. And we just ran with him. Bobby ran with him. And he was so, you know, handsome and young, and he had women swooning over him, and he had all the people. We were putting on these fights in this ice rink in New Jersey and selling out with him, right? Literally from his pro debut. And he made it all the way to a world title. And that was a great accomplishment. He didn't stay with us all the way through, but we I don't really see him much anymore, so I don't really have much information about where he is today.
No, sure. So I had a nice chat with Pat Lynch yesterday, who was singing your praises and talking about your integrity and your dealings with Pat over the years. Tell me about Pat Lynch, who's obviously one of the foremost East Coast managers of the last 20, 30 years.
If you're going to be in a foxhole, that's the guy you want to have with you. And we, you know, I had stepped back from promoting. I was dealing with my family. I had hired someone to run main events, and Pat had been dealing, you know, with that person. And I very abruptly took over. And the day I took over was a few weeks after Gaddy fought Ward the first time. And we were going to HBO to make a deal for Gaddy going forward. And got to realize at this point, everybody thought Arturo Gaddy's career was over. So he wins this fight with Mickey Ward, which was supposed to be a throwaway, you know, send you off on your way, make a few bucks fight. That was the whole purpose of it. And here we are a few weeks later. And Pat at this point really doesn't know me that well. I'd known him, you know, he'd been around since we almost, you know, the start of our business. My husband signed Arturo Gaddy when he turned pro. He knew Pat from then. I remember we had Joe Gaddy, Arturo's brother, before that. I remember my husband pointing to Art, this young boy, one night in Ice World, and it was Art. And he was about maybe 15 or 16 at the time. And Dan said, that's the one. He's the one. He's the one who's going to be the big star. As I said, my husband knew everything. Anyway, so Pat really didn't know me. And we walked into this meeting with Carl Moretti and our attorney, Pat English, and sat down with HBO and demanded millions of dollars for Arturo Gaddy and got it. And part of the way we got it was, you know, they would try to divide and conquer. And you know, they come on, you know, try to pull Pat, you know, to one side, us to the other. And boy, he sat there like a rock. And they were like offering stuff for Arturo that was life changing. And there was, my lawyer believed there was more there. And so we were pushing. And Pat, like a rock, just sat there and said, whatever she says, and they gave us everything we wanted. And that was my introduction to, you know, really to Pat, to know him. Up until then, I just knew him socially. But he was a rock, always a rock, always the guy you want next to you, because he has integrity, he's intelligent, he's just an all-around great person to be with. I love doing business with him.
He also did have a good relationship with Dino, though. Were you worried about losing Arturo, like... Because I suppose Pat, because I think he told me that Arturo came out of contract with you guys, mm-hmm. and he could have gone to Dino, but he stayed with you.
Yes, and at that point, Gary Shaw was running main events, so that deal was made there. But so I was not heavily involved at that point. I really didn't get that involved in Arturo's career until after the first Ward fight, and from then on, I negotiated every one of his deals and with Pat and. I got to say, for a guy whose career was over, we did pretty well.
I mean, yeah, that's enough for a lifetime of itself, isn't it? So tell me about that rivalry that you had with Floyd, because I remember writing when I wrote a Floyd book a few years ago that Arturo and Floyd didn't get on to the point where you had to have different press conferences, one day and one the next day, right?
Yes, we went. that's going in my book, boy. We went to have dinner. Breakfast on the morning of the press conference with Bob Arum and Todd DeBuff, because they had Mayweather and Pat Lynch wasn't there. I was there. Carl Moretti was there. And we were sitting down and just having breakfast and getting ready to go to the press conference. And I get a phone call from Pat Lynch. And he says, walk away from the table. And he tells me, Art's not coming to the press conference today. What do you mean he's not coming? He's not coming to the press conference. I said, what are you talking about? Well, I went to his apartment to get him, and he opened the door, and he was there with two girls, and he didn't. I think he's still drunk, and I think he's not going to be able to come to the press conference. I'm going, well, give him some coffee, sober him up. Like, everybody in the world is here. We have to. No, he's not coming. So now I have to go back and tell Bob Arum that he's not coming. So I go back to the table, and I sit down, and I go, so we got a problem. And I tell him, Art can't make it to the press conference. He went on a bender and he can't do it. And Arum just looked at me for a second and he's like a beat. He goes, okay, here's what we're going to do. Just like that. I don't do that. My Bob Arum isn't very good. But yeah, here's what we're going to do. And we all sit there looking at it and goes, we're going to do the press conference today with Floyd. And we're going to say they hate each other so much that they can't be in the same room together. And then we're going to do another press conference tomorrow. This was all Bob's idea. And we're going to do another press conference tomorrow with Arturo. And we're going to turn this into twice as much publicity.
Wow. Wow. And it worked.
It worked. Well, that's the genius of Bob Arum. I've learned a lot from him, too. And we went in there and we held that press conference and we told our story. And I mean, they didn't like each other, but that was true. But the real story was Arturo couldn't make it. I don't know what version Pat told you, but that was part of Arturo. Again, if he had been a fighter in the time of social media, he might have had a very different career. But fortunately, his afflictions were more private, and this frequently happened in parallel with press conferences. I think getting up to speak made him very nervous, and yeah. I think he being in the gym and getting ready to fight and being in the ring and fighting, like, that's where he lived. That's where he was comfortable. He couldn't wait for that. When he went to camp, he was training. That was it, you know. But when he had to speak in public, it seems, that's when he would flake out. And I think that's what happened that day.
How sad was it when Arturo... Sorry, we just got a delay there. How sad was it when Arturo hit the end of the line against Alfonso Gomez?
Well, you know, I think... we knew it was coming. The reason we chose out, we fought and fought with HBO over Alfonso Gomez. They didn't want him to fight him. They wanted him to fight somebody, you know, much better. And the fight, remember we had with Kerry Davis, who was in charge at that point, was, look, Kerry, if he doesn't beat Alfonso Gomez, he will know it's time to retire. If he goes in there against Steve Forbes, I think he wanted him to fight, he'll have an excuse. You know, you can't put him in there with a boxer. You can't put him in there with somebody who he's going to view as a superior fighter for other reasons. You got to put him in there with someone he thinks he can beat. And if he can't beat Alfonso Gomez, that will be the end and he will retire. Because all of us wanted him to retire at that point. He needed to retire. Fighting anymore would have been horrible. So we weren't sad that he lost to him. We expected him to lose to him. And in the end, that, you know, that moment that HBO captured, and when we were all together in the locker room after the fight, and, you know, we all got in a circle and he was thanking everybody, like, he knew it was over then. And that was good. It was supposed to be that way.
What wasn't necessarily supposed to be that way was when Arturo passed. How hard was that for you, having, you know, been around him for such a long period of time and obviously seeing so many highs and lows? And obviously, like you said, you had that moment of closure where he was ready for the next chapter. And then obviously the next chapter never really started.
And he was well on his way. In fact, I also got to write the letter that got him his U.S. citizenship. I thought, you know, okay. And in that letter, like, I had to talk about why, you know, why he would be able to still support himself. And it was, well, he's going to be able to work in boxing in other ways. And, you know, I laid them all out and truly believed, you know, we were at that point looking to do boxing series and thought we would bring him in and have him talking, maybe somehow be involved in the broadcast. There were things for him to do. We really did have plans. And then I was at a fight. Tomas Adamek fought that night in Newark. And I was leaving my house to go. And I get a phone call from Rick Reno from Boxing Scene.
Boxing Scene,
and,
yeah.
And he tells me what happened. And I just flat out refused to believe him for about 15 minutes. I just told him that can't possibly be true. You know, it must be some fake report that he can't be dead. That's not possible. So I spent some time tracking it down. Pat Lynch was in Europe. I couldn't
get. Yeah, he was. Yeah, he was in France, I think. Yeah, yeah.
And I had to go to the arena. And then I had to tell absolutely everyone in Arturo's life that he was dead, one by one. Because I walk in the door. And, you know, I see my staff. I see Jolene, who was so close to him. I saw, you know, Mikey Red, one of his best friends. I see all of these people who were in his life, and I had to tell every single one of them. And then I had to tell Pat. Yeah, I had to tell everyone. And everybody reacted the same way. And, disbelief. They all his close friends. Yeah, I don't want to get sued. They had their suspicions about what happened.
Yeah, what happened. Hey, on a more positive note, Kathy, because I can see that that's a trigger for you. I suppose everything's comes to the surface a bit when you have these landmark things like the Hall of Fame. You kind of think about the guys that got you there and the guys that got you in the journey and all the things. Yeah. But you mentioned a very positive period there, and you mentioned Adam Eck in Newark. Like, that was a great phase, wasn't it?
Yeah. You know, he brought us back to life. It was 2008. I thought the company was going to close down after the stock market crashed and everybody, was looking for money. I was during that year, even before that happened, I was starting to close the company down. I didn't think we could go any further. Gaddy and Vargas had both lost at the same time. Their HBO runs ended at the same time, about 2 years earlier. And I kind of stumbled through 2007, and by the time 2008 came, the beginning of the year, I really figured, well, this is it, and I was starting to let people go. And Tomas comes along. My lawyer calls me up and says, Ziggy Rozalski, Tomas's manager. He also managed Andrew Galata, so we knew him very well. He's another great friend, and he had Tomas with Don King. He had gotten him out of his contract with Don King. He'd hired my lawyer to do it. So he said he needs a promoter. He's the number one contender, and somebody has to just represent him as promoter. And you know, will you do it? So I did. And he fought a fight in Europe. Forget who the opponent was. He won the fight. Now he's the mandatory, and he has to fight Steve Cunningham. And so they come to me and say, well, will you promote the fight? And now I have to go deal with Don King to make this fight, which, wasn't the first time. I had a great friend named Jeff Vanderbeek, who was running the Prudential Center at the time. And through mutual friends, I had met him and the people that were running the Prudential Center. And they wanted to know about boxing and, can you bring boxing here? And I always told him, when I have a fight that I think can sell, I'll bring it. But I'm not going to put fights in here and have them fail. So I went to him, and I didn't really know him that well at that time. And I told him, I've got the fight, but here's the deal. I've got to make a deal with Don King, and I'm going to have money up front. And I need help. And so Jeff, he gave me what I needed, and he almost broke even that night. We got him very close. So I was happy about that. We made the fight. We did the fight, fought like cats and dogs with Don King the whole time, still never expecting Tomas to win. Because again, at this point in 2008, we had still never won a decision against the Don King fighter. Wow. So when Tomas didn't knock him out, I just thought, okay, that's it. I get in the ring, and now they announced the decision. I almost fell on the ground because we won. And Don wouldn't shake my hand. And I take that as a point of pride. I did accomplish something my husband couldn't. I won a decision over Don King. And then we started this amazing run, and it was so much fun because, like, for 3 nights out of the year, everybody was Polish. We'd go back there and everybody was dressed in red and white, and whether they were Polish or not, and singing and just having this amazingly good time. And he just kept winning the fights, and it was really a lot of fun.
Yeah, that was great stuff. I remember covering those fights for Boxing News at the time. Hey, there was something that we missed, actually. So obviously you touched upon the Andrew Galata self-destructing in Madison Square Garden. One thing that obviously happened during one of those nights was the riot, right? And obviously there was, Lou was in massive difficulties in the ring with a heart attack. I mean, what are your memories of that? I mean, obviously we talked about Andrew self-destructing, but what about the rest of the carnage in the night?
That was about, like, 5 months after my husband passed. And one of the first times I was out at a big event after that. And I was not sitting close to the ring. I was not actively involved really with main events at that point. So I was kind of in the back with the rest of the family. And so I wasn't up close to it. Lou didn't have a heart attack. He had a defibrillator installed in his chest. And the defibrillator is there, you know, if your heart skips a beat, whatever, or stops beating, it kicks it back, right? It's like gives you an electric shock. What happened was, with all of the chaos that was going on, it kicked off the defibrillator. And that's like getting kicked by a mule, apparently. And Lou got knocked down by that. That's how he ended up on the ground. But we didn't know that at the time. We thought he had a heart attack like everybody else. I remember being in the back. I remember this chaos, this people in the arena just fighting. Rock Newman was handling Riddick Bowe at the time. And they were, that second fight, they were actually the promoter of that fight because Riddick had won the first one. So we were happily not the promoter, which turned out to be a good thing when they started filing lawsuits. But what he had done, Andrew had sold so many tickets, right? There were going to be all these Polish people there. And most of the ticket sales were coming out of areas where we could see, you know, we knew who was selling the tickets. We were out selling the tickets. They were, you know, the money's coming into the box office. And Rock felt that he was concerned that there wasn't going to be that the crowd was going to be pro-Golota. So he literally went out in the streets a couple of days before the fight and had guys hand out tickets. So what you ended up with was a bad situation where, you know, where everybody looked at each other and kind of knew what side they were on. And when the fight started, you know, the Andrew hits bit Riddick low, you know, a couple of times. They finally stop the fight. The Rock and his crew come running into the ring. I remember somebody in his group had phones were huge then. They were the size of walkie-talkies. And he started hitting people somebody was hitting people with the phone. They were attacking Andrew. Lou jumps in the ring. He's trying to stop. George Foreman jumps in the ring. He's trying to stop things from happening. And they carry Lou out. And meanwhile, there's these waves of fighting that are going on. And they would go on for like 10 or 15 minutes. And they'd die down. And then all of a sudden, it would start up again. And back then, the police were not allowed to be in Madison Square Garden. That rule changed that night. But there were no police officers inside. They were just these very old men who belonged to the Ushers Union, and they were not in any position to stop what was happening. So this fighting went on for, I think, about an hour. It was crazy. Wow. But Lou came by, and they put him in an ambulance, and I stood there and said, well, either I go with Lou or I stay here and try to deal with what's going on here. And I, in the end, said, I think I got to go with Lou. So I did, and I went to the hospital, and I stayed there until it was clear that he was okay. I started calling up reporters to tell him about his condition. And then I had to go to the police station to give an interview about what I'd seen and what had happened. And then I got home at about 8 o'clock in the morning and saw three very stunned children wondering why their mother was wearing the same clothes she had on when she left last night. And I finally went to sleep. Yeah, that was, oh my God, it was horrifying. It was amazing. It was another thing that happened in my archive, which is pretty cool to watch now.
Hey, obviously you mentioned that Dan had died that year. He was just 44. That is to be the worst thing that you've experienced, right?
Oh, of course.
That period. Yeah.
By far. Yeah. Yeah, I started writing about that. My daughter, I have one daughter who's a filmmaker, and she's pestering me to write everything down, you know. And I started doing it during the pandemic, and I started writing about everything that happened when I got to that part. I haven't been able to go back. Wow. It's almost 8 years, because it's really hard. The memories are here in the back of my head, but to sit there and call them up and then start writing them down and facing them again was hard. And also, like, you don't want to sound like you're feeling sorry for yourself. You don't want to sound overly dramatic, you know, but these were dramatic things that happened, and they were very, very hard. And it's like today I look back and I wonder how I got through it, but I think it was just, you know, put one foot in front of the other each day. And that's what I advise widows now when I meet them. You just have to have faith that somehow you'll find your way through this forest, and you just got to go like one tree at a time and look around it. And that's what we did.
And I did read, I read an old interview of you, I think it was with Thomas Hauser years ago, when he said that you were worried about your identity at the time, you know, because you were Dan's other half. And like, you know, are you going to have a future in boxing? Are you going to be accepted in boxing now you don't have him behind you? Like, was that a big area of concern for you, thinking like, am I going to have to do something completely different with my life? Or did you think, no, I'm in boxing, this is what I'm going to do? Or is this where the other law, you know, where you moved into the law side of things?
That's when I moved into the law. One of the first fights I went to, I was there without Dan, and I saw Russell Peltz. He didn't recognize me. He's a dear friend, and I'd known him for years. And to this, you know, today, to this day, he'll apologize for not recognizing me. But without Dan, without standing by Dan's side, I mean, I was just Dan's other half. I had my own identity. I worked. I did publicity. I had done publicity on very high level fights. I had earned the respect of people I worked with, you know, at the major hotels and things, who, when I walked in as the boss's wife, kind of, you know, gave me a look. And by the time I left, you know, we were all friends. I had accomplished a great deal. I knew that, but I was still Dan's wife. And I knew as well as Russell didn't recognize me. I had to wonder how many other people didn't know who I was. And a lot of people didn't. And at the same time, trying to work with my husband's family, we were all in so much pain. We were all, you know, having suffered the same loss, incapable of sympathizing with the other, because we were both all feeling it, you know, in the same way. I realized that if I kept working with my family, with my husband's family, I would not be able to keep working. We would not be able to maintain our relationship. So I was trying very hard to do that. And so I just like stood in my kitchen one day and said, well, if you could do anything you wanted to do in the world, what would it be? Because I was off. Dan left me pretty well off financially. So it wasn't like it was a crisis in that respect. And so I said, well, I really always did want to be a lawyer, and I never would say it to Dan. I would have felt like I was somehow disloyal, you know, not spending my time working with the business, not helping him. And I didn't know how it would be received. I would have expected, you know, he would have laughed. And so I just always kind of kept that to myself. And, but he was a lawyer, and he was the kind of person who would teach you as he was doing anything. It just the way he did. He was saying this stuff out loud, helped his thought process. So I was on the receiving end of a lot of this instruction. And so I had learned a great deal. Even when he was in law school, I mean, I used to go help him research his projects, and I used to type up his papers for him. So I had been around it. And so I decided to go into law school in order to get away from the business. And then I would have a career, and then I would be able to continue to support my kids. I really didn't think I would stay in boxing at that point.
What did you want from the law thing? Because I was going to say, was that so that you could compete, you know, and sort of know a bit more about that and apply it to the boxing business? But if boxing was not your going to be your go-to thing, were you going to be, what kind of, were you literally just going to be like a criminal lawyer? Were you just going for a complete 180?
I studied intellectual property, because we deal in intellectual property, right? So I had some interest in copyright, because I had this archive. I knew I had that. And so I wanted to learn more about, you know, the laws as it pertained to that. And also, Dan had left his estate in a very convoluted group of trusts and stuff. In his, God love him, attempt to control us from beyond, he wanted us to force us to work together. And so he set it up so we had to. And that really was a problem. And so I was trying to figure out how to unravel this. And as a result, I had, in working with lawyers, I had been reading law review articles about estates and trusts. I had really gotten into this before I went to law school. And at one point in a meeting, I corrected a lawyer about something that he said about the trust. And like, I was paying him like $400, $800 an hour. And the guy with him was getting $400 an hour, which is an awful lot of money at that point. And the $800 guy, I corrected him. And the $400 guy went, oh shit, she's right. And so I started having people ask me, are you a lawyer? And I like, no, I didn't know anywhere near the things lawyers know, but I was getting very involved in this estates and trusts. So I had a feeling if I was going to end up anywhere, it would be there. But that didn't work out the way I planned.
Did you stay estranged from that side of the family?
Well, while I was in law school, they filed a lawsuit against me, which made it kind of hard to stay close. So we spent a couple of years going through the process of the lawsuit, and that certainly caused the estrangement. At that point, they stopped working at the company. That's when I brought Gary Shawn, because I was still in law school and I didn't want to quit. I wanted to finish. I still had 2 years left. And I had also gone through a bout of breast cancer while all this was going on, and I was having my treatments, and I was in no shape to be running main events. So I stepped away. All of these things happened. First the cancer, you know, while I was in law school. Yeah, I walked away. I went to law school, got cancer while I was in law school. And you know, hired Gary when they all walked out while I was in law school. And then I came back and didn't get along very well with Gary once I got back. So that didn't last very long. And then I ended up negotiating Arturo Gatti's deal with Mickey Ward. And that's kind of how it happened.
Wow. So, geez, you have had more than your fair share, haven't you? There's got to be times where you think, don't you just want a quiet life now?
Every time I think that, then I find out what it's like. See, like this pandemic has been great because I finally got it, right? I always wondered what that would be like.
So when I finished, you had when no I
finished choice. Cleaning every inch of my house, and then I cleaned out the attic and the garage, and threw away things. And, you know, then I have a house here at the shore where I am today. I came here and I started cleaning every inch of this house. It came to a point where I realized, like, I really need to have something to do. I'm not good at doing nothing. And while it was nice not to have to worry about too many boxing things for a while and to just put it out of my mind because there was nothing I could do about it, now that we're back and there's some action, I'm having a good time. So I got my rest. I found out what it was like. I'm good with what I got.
who are the red hot prospects who never made it for you?
Oh, well... Okay, there was a guy years ago named Rafael Pineda. He looked like the real deal. He did okay. I think he won a world title, but he didn't turn out to be what we thought. We thought Joel Julio looked like the real thing. He ended up with all kinds of personal problems, and he just did not have the drive. He had all the talent in the world. Another was Francisco Bajardo, who had all the talent in the world, but didn't have the drive. The drive matters more in the end. That's, again, Evander Holyfield. Put him up against Lennox Lewis, and physically, you know, he's no match, right? But he got in a ring with him, and he beat him. Because, or at least drew with him, maybe. But, I mean, in the end, it was all because of his drive. I once asked Evander, what would you do if you had Lennox's body? And he said, I would have never been as great as I am because I wouldn't have had anything to prove. And I think it's drive. And when I look at a young fighter now, of course we look for talent. There's lots of talent out there, but if they don't have the drive, they're never going to get there. No matter what you do for
talking about drive, did you deal much with Vinny Paz back in the day?
Oh, all the time, completely. Yes.
Any good Vinny Paz stories?
God, there's too many. too many. Most I can't tell. you know, the thing with Vinny, he was another, you know, guy with a wild life outside the ring. We seem to specialize in these guys. We worked with Aaron Pryor for a while. We worked with Vinny. We worked with Livingstone Bramble. Talk about crazy. Well, he actually pretended to be crazy. He really wasn't. But he put on such a good act, we believe it. We worked with a lot of people, you know, Fernando Vargas and just a whole lot of guys that have this Arturo, who, you know, have this out-of-ring life that is, you know, out of control. And Vinny was one of them. And he came from this whole world in Providence, Rhode Island that we had never seen before. You know, very, very close-knit Italian family, definitely lots of mobsters up around there. They weren't involved in his career, at least not to our knowledge, but he was another one. You know, he was we sold out, you know, the arena in Providence with him. They told us one night that the biggest crowd prior to that was Frank Sinatra. He broke that record. And, you know, everybody came to see him fight. It was a party. It was so much fun. And I ended up missing some of those because it turned out he would always fight in the third week of June for some reason. That's when, like, they put him on the schedule. And my daughters would have their dance recitals on the same day. So a lot of the time I would be talking to Dan on the phone. When he fought Greg Haugen, my husband told me that my daughter had a dance recital. And so I was home with the girls and they were, and I'm on a payphone talking to him at this point because we didn't have cell phones. And he's telling me that Vinny is dehydrated. He's got a fever. He doesn't know if he can even fight. And he doesn't know what's about to happen because if we don't win the fight tonight, our company's going to go out of business. we don't have any more cash. We're done. And he's telling me this story. And I said to him, okay, so when the kids get sick like that, we give them Pedialyte. And that's not something everybody knew about at the time. If you had a baby, you knew about it. Because when they got diarrhea, Vinny had that too. Give him Pedialyte. I said, why don't you give him Pedialyte? So Dan went and got it and gave it to him. And he won the fight. And we stayed in business. So,
Wow, that's amazing.
Then when he had his car accident, you know, Dan really like loved him like he was his son. He really did. He was more emotionally attached to Vinny than any fighter we've ever had. And he, when he got in that accident, you know, we get the call and we thought he was going to die. And then, you know, a few weeks later, we're up in Providence and this psycho is training with this halo braid head on. I'm sure you've seen the footage. I'm coming back. And he did. That's a great story.
Yeah, definitely. Talking of great stories, I mean, you mentioned that about a book. Are you doing one?
Yeah, I'm trying. I'm not a writer like you. I'm just writing this stuff down. Like I'm doing what I did in college. I'm going to write a crappy first draft and hope in law school, right? That's how you write. I'm going to write a really bad first draft and then I'm going to see what happens with it next. And I'm still... Yeah, I have to like get back to it now. I know I've made a lot of excuses. When I got through that, I listened to this interview with Mick Jagger and he said they gave him a big advance to write a book and he started writing it and he started remembering a lot of things he didn't want to remember and he gave him the money back. And I totally understand. What he was thinking. It's hard when it's your life. I can tell these stories and I can write them down and I'm writing them down in the book. And that's fun. That makes me happy. It's bringing back, you know, usually happy times. But when you have to start talking about what went on in your own head during these times and really get honest about it and really get honest about the details of the estrangement from the family, that's really hard. And I'll get through it. But
have you had counseling for that stuff?
Excuse me?
Did you have counseling for that stuff? Have you had any counseling for that stuff?
Oh, I've had plenty of counseling, of course. Yeah. Oh my God. And no, I am a true believer in going to professionals when you have problems. I've had it. My kids have had it. The hardest part really of all of this was raising my kids. It wasn't the boxing, not even close. Three grief stricken children. That's a lot. And I had a similar experience. I lost a parent when I was 7. I lost my mother. And my son was 7 when Dan died. So I kind of really understood. My girls were like 11 and 13. Like I understood what was going on in their heads. I really did. But that didn't seem to help when I said, well, I know what you're going through. I went through it too. It's like, don't make it about you, mom. It's about us, you know, which is what goes through your head. It's about you if you're a kid. It's got nothing to do with your parents. It's got nothing to do with what your remaining parent is going through. They don't care. They don't want to know. They're a child. They are programmed to protect themselves as they should be. And I was the same way when I was 7. So they lash out and they get angry and you have to basically be the person who takes it all. And then I am not an assertive person. Dan was the captain of the ship, right? I was really happy to be the first mate. I felt really comfortable in that role. And the hardest thing for me in all these years has been to become the person in charge. And at that point, I really, my kids were more in charge than I was, if I want to be honest. I had to learn to do that with them. And my daughter, Lisa, the writer, who's very perceptive, just told me she realized the day everything changed when we went on a trip and I went and checked into the hotel room instead of her father, because she had always seen Dan take charge of everything. But when he was ill, I had to start stepping up. And that transition was the hardest. One time, my son got interviewed when he was about 13 about me, a story about me in a local paper. And they said, you know, it must be really something having a mother who can, you know, can deal with Don King. You know, what's it like? And my son went, I don't know how the heck she deals with Don King. She is the easiest person in the world. Like, she's a pushover. And I just had a very different relationship with my kids, even probably still today, than I do with the rest of the world. But that's the thing I'm proudest of, is that they're all still here and they're all healthy and they're all successful in their own careers. And now I'm going to try to keep being successful in mine.
What's the biggest hit you've ever taken on a show? Financial hit.
That was when Aaron Pryor fought Alexis Arguello.
First time or second time?
It was the second one. Bob Arum promoted the first one. Dan got the rights. Dan and Shelley got the rights to the second one. And we spent 9 months of our, again, without the internet, without modern technology, things that we do with a push of a button and don't even think about took weeks. So again, we spent 9 months promoting that fight. You couldn't do a closed circuit / pay-per-view. That was still pay-per-view. That was 1983. It was late 83. My daughter was born early 83, and this fight took place in September of 83. From the time she was born, I went back to work 2 weeks later, you know, all the way through to September, all we did was work on that fight. We had no other income. We had, you know, paying people to work for us at that point, because now there was a company and people were getting salaries. And we went for 9 months with no income at all. And we did the fight, and the fight lost money. And that was the biggest hit, because we didn't have the money to lose. And so at that point, I wasn't involved in the finances. Dan was very much, as he used to call himself, a benevolent dictator. The rest of us, including the rest of his family, didn't know what was going on with finances or anything like that. I knew we lost money. I knew we hadn't made any money in 9 months. I could figure out that this was a problem. Whatever reserves we had, we went through, and probably then some. And I imagine he took out a loan or something to pull us through it.
Hey, I think we've seen I think we've seen different sides of you today, right? We've seen the business side of you. We've seen maybe the more sentimental side of you. One side we haven't seen, and hopefully this is because of me, is the angry side of you. And I've seen that when. Obviously, Kovalev and Andre Ward in Vegas, right? And you went nuts.
I did. I don't do that very often. I mean, I don't do that. That's not me. And now when people Google me, that's the first thing they see. They think I'm crazy. And I was really upset. And, you know, other than losing it on my kids, because parents lose it on their kids, that just happens. And if you have, you know, as I did, three teenagers at one time to raise by yourself, there will be moments when you completely lose it. So they've seen it, but the rest of the world had really never seen it. Never. So I lost it. I was so mad. He just kept hitting them low over and over. And they weren't just on the cup. They were under and up, which I am told is very painful. And and the referee acted like it never happened. Oh, I'm still mad about that. Sorry.
Wow. But so the Kovalev journey, is that like a sort of more modern day version of the Adamek journey?
Yeah, except we do it in Russia instead of Poland, where we did. Can't go there anymore. But but it was, you know, in a lot of ways, it's exactly the same. I found Adamek when I was about to go under. When we signed Sergey, we weren't quite in as desperate a situation. We had a deal with NBC. We had a series, you know, things were going well. I met Agus Klamis and he said, I've got this fighter and I want you to take a look at him. Just put him in a fight. And if you don't want him, you'll never hear from me again. And I've taken him to every promoter in the United States and Canada and nobody wants him. And I don't understand why, because he's going to be champion of the world. And so we put him on a show, which was easy for us to do at that time, and took one look at him and went, oh my God, sign this guy before somebody else figures out what I just did. Like, oh my God, no, this guy can fight. I just saw this fire in him, the drive. It was there. It was obvious. When the fight started, I looked across the ring and I saw these eyes coming out of his head. Like, they reminded me of Ray Leonard's eyes the night that he fought Thomas Hearns. Like, I was kind of opposite. I was on the ring that night. I saw Ray's eyes up close and I saw the same eyes. And so we found each other at exactly the right moment. I was in a position to help him and he was in a position to help me. You know, I needed a world-class fighter that I could work with. And, you know, I'm a small promoter. I am not going to get the guys coming off the Olympic team in the United States or, you know, the big hot prospects. They're going to go sign with people that can give them lots of money. I did not have that to offer to Sergey. Sergey had been fighting for nothing up until that point. Agus had just been supporting him. He wasn't getting purses or anything. So I paid him his first purse and we are together still. And he is, you know, he's not a perfect person. And I know a lot of people, you know, I know all the negatives, but they don't know in the way I know him. And he has been a wonderful person to deal with in a business setting.
You mentioned that, I mean, in a way, you've obviously had these wild childs that we've talked about, and then some guys you've got to go into bat for. Obviously, Sergey's had the racism thing. Evander's had the stuff where he's been linked to PEDs. You've got Arturo, who is obviously a good time guy away from the ring, who's obviously, you know, like you said, had his flaws. Is it hard to defend these guys sometimes? Has there been anyone where you've had to cut them loose and say, look, sorry, I can't do anything with that?
Yeah, I mean, Adamek's a good example. You know, when he lost to Mike Tyson, people were saying he quit.
Oh, Glotta, yeah, sorry.
And did I say it? I'm sorry, Glotta.
Adamek, yeah.
Glotta, I'm sorry, Andrew Glotta. He lost to Mike Tyson, and Showtime had that clause in the contract, you know, that if you don't give a good performance, we're not going to pay you. And they were threatening not to pay him. And I had to go to bat for him. And I did. And I got a lot of grief for it, not just from Showtime, from some people on my own team. And I said, look, he got knocked down and he got up and he kept fighting. He could have quit then. He didn't. And he's in the ring with Mike Tyson. And at that point, you know, I knew he was having panic attacks. I realized this must be what happened. That's not quitting exactly. When you think you're going to die, I don't know if you've ever had a panic attack. I had one once. That was enough to show me, you know, how helpless you are when it happens. And so I had to go to bat for him because I didn't want to pay him. And I was having a hard time finding people in my own company to do it. So I did it. That was hard. I was doing interviews. Everybody in the world was saying he quit. Everybody was condemning him. And I'm there, the one lone voice saying, wait a minute, the man's in the ring with Mike Tyson. You really don't get to criticize him. He's a fighter. You don't get to criticize a guy who puts himself in that kind of danger deliberately and loses to Mike Tyson. No, you don't. And then later on, I got to the point with Andrew where I didn't feel comfortable with him. He was always making jokes and things that women have become accustomed to over time. You know, I wasn't going to put up with it, and I released him then. And he went to Don King, but when it comes to Sergey, I don't have any problem defending him because I do believe everything I'm saying. I don't believe. How do I put it? It's easy to point fingers at people when you don't really know them because they say something that might be perfectly acceptable in their culture and is not in ours. He had to deal with a great deal of culture shock when he got here. He's dealing with it. He comes from, as we're seeing now, a completely different world. If you pay attention to any of the stuff that's going on in Russia now, you'll see that their attitude toward race, toward just about everything, is different than ours. In Russia, Sergei is a wild-eyed liberal, but here, you know, he's probably to the left of most of the people on the right here. But you know, he has said things that he shouldn't, that were unfortunate, and he's had to learn a lot about what's okay. I'll say this: whenever he's made a mistake, I have sat with him and talked to him, and he has come around to either understanding what he did wrong or saying, "Kathy, I accept if you tell me it was wrong, then it was wrong. I won't do it again." And nobody's perfect. They all have flaws. Boxers are not perfect. Perfect boxer? I don't know that that's possible, because you don't do this unless there's something a little bit off about you. And I mean that in the nicest way. They're all guys who have something about them that's different than people who don't fight. And I think that's what makes them interesting and fun. But you have to accept that. You can't turn them into somebody they're not. Yeah. And I don't try to do that. I just try to accept who they are and recognize, like I do when my son does something that drives me crazy and aggravates me. It doesn't make me not care about him. It aggravates me and makes me mad, but you know, he's still my son. Well, they're still my fighters, and it's my job to stick up for them. And so I do.
Hey, I remember I went to that fight, Golota Tyson in Auburn Hills, back in the Palace, back in the day. And the weird thing is, I suppose the thing is, when you look at that, when you look at the build-up, everyone knew something was going to happen, right? And that was how the fight was sold.
You've got these two. That's what they wanted.
Exactly. So they got what they wanted, and then they got their talking point. They got the controversy. Job done.
And that's what I was saying to Jay Larkin the next day. You got what you wanted. You got exactly what you wanted. What did you think was going to happen? You've seen this guy melt down before. What did you think? It wasn't going to happen again? But anyway, he did get paid. It was okay in the end.
Okay, Kathy, I really appreciate your time. Just last couple from me, okay?
Okay.
One is, you once sued Al Haymon. What's your take on him and what he's done in the
sport? I never sued him.
Didn't you?
No. Aram did, and Golden Boy did. I didn't.
Oh, I thought you were part of that. I thought you were the part of the no, okay. What's your take on Al? Because we don't get to see or hear much about Al, obviously.
Yeah. Well, you know, Al took away my TV series. So has great TV series going at NBC, and they're telling me, hey, we're going to keep working with you as long as you keep putting on good fights and getting good ratings. And I did. And then one day it was time to negotiate a new contract, and they ghosted me. And I'm like, what's going on? And then finally somebody told me, well, this guy came along, Al Haymon, and he's going to pay NBC for the time, and he's going to pay for all the production. He's going to pay for all the fights. So thanks. We don't need you anymore. And so I was pretty angry. And also, excuse me, I had Sergey Kovalev, who we were lining up to fight Adonis Stevenson. Sergey had even fought Ismail Salak in Montreal. And the next fight we were working on was for Sergey to go to Montreal and fight Stevenson. So we were, you know, he had already beaten Nathan Cleverly, and, you know, we were going to do a unification. So Al signs, right, this is all at the same time. He signs up Stevenson. So now all of a sudden that fight goes away. We can't make a deal anymore. And I'm hearing, well, yeah, Adonis wants to fight him. And well, yeah, Yvonne Michelle wants to make the fight, but Al says we can't. So it was all on Al. And that got me upset. And then years before, I hadn't even realized it, but when my family was running Main Events after Dan died, we had built up Vernon Forrest and got him to the world title fight. And the fight ended in, I think, a no contest. And so they had to do it over. And at that point, he was out of the contract, the way the contract was worded. And so we did it. And then Al took him away. So I had these experiences with him. I had also worked with him when Chris Areola fought Tomas Adamek. We got along fine. We had very nice conversations. I had, you know, we didn't have any problem with each other. I asked him, hey, do you want to bring me fighters? And he called up and he offered me Lawan Brewster. And I think at that point it was Vernon again at the end of his career. I'm not sure if it was him or somebody else. But at that point, I just said, these guys, like, their careers, I can't do anything for them. Why are you bringing me these guys? I want like a guy who can fight. You know, I want like a Mayweather kind of guy. And so I passed on that. And then, of course, they had dates on HBO a few weeks later. I didn't understand how it worked at that point. So I had had some, my experiences with Al had not been great. And I didn't like him. And I was very outspoken about how I felt about him, because I'm not the kind of person who pretends they like people when they know. And I just, it's a flaw, whatever, but that's who I am. I wasn't going to pretend it was okay when he took away my series. But I have to say, in recent years, we have ended up in situations where we're working with the PBC. I've got Bakra Mirtosalaev, who is lined up most likely to Charlo before the end of the year. I've been working with them for the last couple of years on work with Tom Brown and his whole team. And the experience has been delightful, and we've been getting along great. So at the moment, Al and I are totally at peace.
What is your take on Eddie Hearn?
Well, you know, I knew Eddie's father a long, long time. And we used to work, when my husband was alive, we worked together. I've met Barry over the years many times, even during the time when they weren't doing boxing. You know, when he was in New York, we would catch up. So he's an old friend. And so I kind of came into this as his father's friend, which probably didn't help my case. You know, I know how that goes. I haven't really been successful in doing any business with Eddie. And I think part of the reason is because I was always, you know, headed in through Barry. And now I am, you know, Barry's totally stepped away, and I recognize that that is not the way to get anything done. So I am really not personally involved with Eddie at all.
What's your take on what he's doing with DAZN and that kind of stuff? Interested? Do you follow it all closely, what he's up to?
Oh, of course. I think what he did in England was astonishing. I mean, he did an amazing job of bringing boxing back. He did. I can't fault the mistake, if there is one, and I told this to Barry a long time ago, is that you don't understand the U.S. market. Don't think you do, because you don't. And I don't know why you don't want to work closely with promoters like me who do. And he said, no, you know, we're going to do it our way, and we know how to do it. And God bless. So I think he's got a mixed bag there. He's had great success in the UK, but from what I can see, you know better than I do, but in the US, it's just different. People aren't going to come to a fight because of the person who promotes it. They don't. They didn't do it when Don King was promoting fights. They came because of the fighter. And I think just as I would not be know where to start to try to market something into the UK, where I know nothing of the culture other than what I can watch from over here, I think promoting fights in the US is different. And I don't know that that's really sunk in yet. But hey, I'm sure he's...
When we started talking, you did mention about being a lady in boxing, and there was sort of a nod to discrimination. Has it been really bad for you over the years? Horrendous.
It's horrendous for every woman who's in business in a position of authority. It's been no worse for me than my friends who are judges and lawyers and doctors. I have friends, women who are in all those positions, and we sit sometimes and as conversations go and start trading stories, and I find out they've been treated no differently than me. In some respects, I might have had it better. The people who will work with me, the Sergey Kovalevs, the Andrew Galatas,
Arturos.
Yeah, Arturo for sure. Those people, for whatever reason, can accept the fact that a woman is in charge. I still tease Tomas Adamek because our lawyer was very close with him. And when he started working with us, we literally had to let him think the lawyer was running everything because Tomas had a hard time with it.
Wow.
He came around. And, you know, Ziggy's manager has been great. And I, to some extent, it's cultural. In other cases, it's just individuals and their preference. The people who want to work with us, who don't have a problem, great relationships with all of them. The people who just can't take it, they don't work with us, and that's fine. I can't force myself on people, and I can't work with somebody who doesn't want to work with me. So the fighters I work with treat me with respect. They have all been wonderfully, what's the word? We have good personal relationships. We have good business relationships. It's been great. It's been a pleasure. The ones who can't take it, like I said, I don't have to work with the establishment of the boxing world. The fact that they're giving me this award shows that they have honored, they have accepted me. They have treated me, with respect. And I'm very happy they're also inducting a whole bunch more women, because I'm like only the third woman who ever got voted in and the first living one. Their goal to make it to next week, because I wanted to be the first one to be inducted alive. But there's a whole bunch of others coming with me, boxers. And I think that's great. But I have had problems with some promoters who couldn't take it. It's funny, Don King, he treats me like anybody else. He will screw me over just as much. Same with Bob Arum, just as much as anybody else. I love that about the two of them. There are others who I won't name who literally have been forced to sit in meetings with me because they just can't figure out how to deal with a woman. And that's their worldview, and have been forced. Actually, one TV executive told me that he told a particular promoter, well, you just treat her like you treat any, like a man, just you don't treat her differently. I don't want to be treated differently. And so it's been a mixed bag in that respect, but there's enough people in the business that are progressive enough that this is no longer an issue for them. And that's good for me.
Obviously, there was that huge night in the Garden recently with Amanda Serrano and Katie Taylor. Are you thrilled to see the lady side of the sport really sort of growing and taking off?
Oh, yeah. You know, when it started, you know, Arum and King were putting like Christy Martin, who's also going to the Hall of Fame, you know, on undercards. And it was kind of a sideshow. And I didn't like that about it. I felt like, you know, people say to me, do you work with women? You know, and I haven't. And part of the reason was like I wasn't going to do it until like the women's fights were as significant as the men's fights, where women were being matched the way men were, where women were being paid the way men were. Now I'm totally open to it. But up until recently, and the pandemic, you know, threw everything out of whack, I need to have a TV series again to be able to do it. But I absolutely intend to when we go back. I think it's great. They finally got to that place. And for that, Eddie Hearn deserves all the credit in the world. And I think it's wonderful.
Yeah. Well, Kathy, I really appreciate your time. We're 2022, but you're a 2020 Hall of Fame inductee, and I hope you really enjoy your time up in the sun in Canastota next week. I think it's going to be amazing.
It is next week. Yeah, I can't believe it. 3 years. It's been a long
Brilliant.
Week.
Yeah, well,
that's great.
Yeah, I look forward to seeing you there. Thank you very much for your time. I'm really grateful.
You're welcome. Take care.
Okay. Take care. Safe travels. Bye, Kathy. Bye-bye.
So that was exceptional from Kathy. I really enjoyed speaking to her. And as I said at the start, you know, what a worthy inductee into the International Boxing Hall of Fame. And it will be great to see her going in on Sunday. Before I wrap up this episode, huge thanks to Hanson Lee Resourcing. They were voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm at the Corporate Excellence Awards. Not only do Hanson Lee find you the best people, but they help you retain them, and you can find out more at hansonlee.com. You can find me on Patreon at patreon.com/TrisDixon, where it helps you, or where you have the opportunity to support this podcast moving forwards. It's a way of basically donating to independent content creators like myself, so that it allows us to carry on doing the job that we are doing. Also looking to hopefully expand this suite of podcasts in the not too distant future. Huge thanks to Kathy Duva. You can find me on social media at TrisDixon on Instagram and Twitter. Most likely Instagram, I'll be putting some stuff up from the International Boxing Hall of Fame on my travels this week. And the huge thanks to Kathy Duva. We'll be back next week.